Hello and welcome back to the Stop Stressing Me Out podcast. I'm your host, Victoria Smith, and this week I wanted to have a conversation about what is the role that HR play in the stress management of an organization. It's a topic I think a lot of us, if we've been through burnout, if we've ever taken a stress leave before, have asked ourselves, what is the role of our manager versus our department versus HR? Who's ultimately responsible? What are the things HR can do to support us through a situation like this? And when I was having this conversation, I knew I wanted to talk to Michelle Berg. So Michelle Berg is the Chief Visionary Officer at Elevated HR, which is a company she founded in 2010 with a bold mission to transform the very essence of human resources. Now, I first heard of Michelle way back in 2012, 2013, so in the early years of her business, and I've been following along with her journey ever since. And the reason that she got into this was because she had a, as she describes it, a fiery distaste for traditional HR practices and business malaise. So she really believes in revolutionizing the way that people experience work. Her motto is work shouldn't suck, right? And so that I knew I wanted to have a conversation with someone who would be honest, right? Truly honest about what is the role HR can play. What are their limitations? What do they know? What do they not know? And the same goes for leaders in general, right? So Michelle believes that while work can be indeed challenging, fraught with miscommunication, missed deadlines, and projects that unpredictably veer off course, through discipline and unwavering commitment, it is possible to make incremental improvements every day. And it is this belief in continuous step-by-step progress that drives her pursuit to make work less of a chore and more of a calling. So, like I said, some of the things that we discuss in today's podcast, she gives us a bit of an outline on her career journey. And then we really dive into the pervasiveness of stress in organizations. You know, it's at an all-time 10-year high. We talk about what are the trends that HR are seeing as regards stress in the workplace. What's working for organizations? What's not working for organizations? What about the stress leave? How can we help people transition back from it? And this was my own curiosity itch that I had to scratch, but I also wanted to talk to her about part-time professional work. Why is it not more of a thing? I know so many people anecdotally who would die for a part-time professional role, 30 hours, 25 hours, in order to really maintain that work-life balance. Why does it not exist, and what would need to be in place for it to exist? I absolutely adored my conversation with Michelle, and I think you will as well. So let's head into the interview. Well, thank you so much, Michelle, for joining me on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's funny because I've been following you online for quite some time. And like you and I were just saying before we got on, who you are is who you are online as well. And I've always really appreciated your honesty and transparency of what goes on in the HR world, what works and what doesn't. So I'm really happy to have you join us today.
Well, like I say, thank you again. And anytime I'm given an opportunity to talk things work and more importantly, stress, burnout and all those things, I'm going to say yes every single time.
Awesome. Well, in the vein of that, what's stressing you out today?
Today, it is just juggling priorities. We had a new employee start last week while I was away, and wanting to make sure that she's getting enough of me while my clients are getting enough of me, while my family is getting enough of me, while I'm getting enough of me filling my own cup. I just think that recognizing when to prioritize and taking that step back and taking a breath to draw out my boundaries right now, I haven't done a good job of that over the last few days. And so just needing to do that and get to that when the squirrel is very, very loud or the shiny penny seems to be very, very shiny today, I'm just struggling at staying focused and present where I want to be.
Yeah. Well, I hope that you find some time for yourself later today after this call.
Well, one of the best things about talking about this is the recognition of that's the time I'm actually starting to get conscious. And so verbalizing it, I find helps so much to go, okay, why am I feeling this anxiety or these things that are, you know, just percolating? It's not big, but I know that it's there. And so even just the fact of we're doing this, I go, okay, right after this, I've blocked some time and I'm going to go do that.
Oh, good for you. Well, as we record this, it's Valentine's Day. So what's stressing me out, it's not high stress, but it was the like, do the kids have all their Valentine's Day cards? Did I wash their pink and red clothes and all that kind of stuff? And the activities, professional days, long weekend, all the life stuff is more sort of what navigating the stress of this week for me.
Totally get that. We were in panic zone last night as well and doing the assembly line of Valentine's Day cards. So
My God, there's so
hopefully get
many. There's so many. It's just become a big thing, but for
you.
sure.
Yeah,
So
absolutely.
for our listeners who don't know who you are, could you maybe start us off with a bit of a rough outline of like what your career has looked like and how Elevated came to be?
Sure. So I started in human resources, technically back in 2000. It was a part-time role while I was going to university, working with children with autism. And then when I graduated, I decided I'm going to go to Korea and be a teacher. And when they kind of learned that I had this human resources background, they decided immediately to put me in human resources in Korea and asked me to do all things HR. They thought I would be good at, employment branding and retaining and attracting staff all the way in Korea. So I did that for a year, came back, and then had a couple of really great opportunities that where I was at the right place at the right time. Not that I necessarily had the experience, but got elevated, for a lack of better words, very, very quickly. And then I came to a place where I saw work probably at its most toxic before we were talking about psychological safety or any of those things, and realized that I no longer wanted to be part of it. My soul, I recognized my soul had had a price at that point. I was being paid incredibly well. But at the same time, when you are paid to do things that are so anti who you are, anti your integrity, I just couldn't see myself staying in that situation any longer. And so I decided to start Elevated. And that idea came from the fact that I was very lucky in this role that I did get international experience, that I was flying around. Unfortunately, I was flying around terminating people. I very much was up in the air and the movie. And as I'm flying, I realized I was really embarrassed to say that I was in human resources. But at the same time, every time that a conversation would strike, I would get the, oh, I run a small business. What would you do in this situation? And so back in 2010, the word fractional HR really didn't exist. HR consulting existed, but a lot of them were single person shops. And I thought, well, gee, those single person shops tend to work with the big oil and gas companies here in Calgary, or they're bigger shops that they'll just consult in and out and leave. I thought, well, what about the little people? The little companies, I mean. So really focusing on 5 employees to about 100, how could we help them to get up, from startup to scale up realistically? And so that's what I've been doing. And very quickly, we've grown both from an employee perspective as well as the types of services that we provide. It escalated during the pandemic where we were able to actually offer even more across North America because people were used to being remote. I didn't need to go see people in person anymore. And so again, from recruitment to compensation to performance management, we handle that all now. And we are one of the very few that, as an HR consulting firm or a fractional HR firm, we are 100% employee based. And that means I don't hire contractors. We do it all ourselves, and I take the risk, from that perspective. But I've been very much of the mind that if I'm going to help others, leaders, build their companies and their cultures, I very much wanted to be able to do that ourselves. And that's actually when I became, I think personally, an even better HR practitioner, because now I'm living it. I'm living budgets, I'm living stress, I'm living, of leading people in a completely different way that I can translate those experiences back to other CEOs and entrepreneurs as well.
And I think you do a great job of that because it was even just, I think, a couple of weeks ago, you're talking about the trust that an employer has to have with their employees of, someone's had an extra long day and, trusting that they're taking, when they take a little time for themselves, that that's not an abuse of the situation, that that is them, taking care of themselves. Like, I think you're always great at sharing these examples on LinkedIn. So for anyone who's listening, I highly recommend that you check that out. Your motto is work shouldn't suck. And yet you look at like the Gallup surveys of the lack of engagement we're experiencing. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, work can really suck. So what is your, if there was a North Star that organizations could follow, I know it's not a one size fits all. I know there's nuances, but like, what's the North Star organizations should aim for?
Well, I can speak for myself in that because it actually is even our vision, is a world in which work and life can integrate seamlessly. And what that means for me then is, again, it's very much, as you said, it's a foundation of trust. So recognizing that I'm going to have conversations with my people, that they're going to do the right things for me. When it does work for them. And I know that that sounds like altruistic at times, but I find that when I demonstrate that kind of trust for my team, that mitigates all the other stuff that's going on for them. Because and I'm also known to say this too. I actually think organizations need to stop engagement surveys, that the actual Gallup in itself, there's a 12 questionnaire, but so many of those things are dependent on A, what happened to me that day? What happened to me? It actually has nothing to do with work. Work is one of five or six things that I've got to be thinking about as a human being. And I think Randy Zuckerberg said, there's five things in life, pick three, right? So it's like family, fitness, friends, sleep, and something else. I'm blanking on it, but that's the gist. It is that we're going to choose the things that make sense, or we've got to get conscious about the things to go handle, and then come back to work when we need to. Work, in a sense, is one third of our lives if we work 8 hours a day, and it's recognizing that when those 8 hours happen, it's not always going to be in the same orderly way. It's not a 9 to 5. And again, I want to recognize my privilege when I say things like that as well, is that we work in an office setting. It's not a retail setting where, you've got that might be a little bit different, but to expect high engagement on the exact day we're asking about it just doesn't, on that day, and using that day, not knowing what's going on for people, and then using that as our barometer, I'm not sure that that's always the right thing that organizations should be measuring. But if you ask a question like, even if you're having a crappy day, does my manager know and not jump to conclusions? Or even if you're having a day, do you feel safe enough to put up your hand and say yes? And those aren't technically measurements of engagement. Those are they could be, but not in the broader, those questions haven't necessarily been tested. But to make sure you have a process or a system where people feel safe enough to do that, that to me is more important, that that's in place. Because again, it still comes down to employees also choosing to do it and whether they trust you enough. Well, that all, I think that we could dive into that down the line, but that trust too is on their past experiences, on their lived experiences, whether or not they're going to trust you. But if they know, if they intuitively know that there's a process in place that I can feel safe and say the things that's happening, that is really where organizations, that's what I think that they need to focus on, is making sure the process is in place and it's not broken. Never mind just focusing on these nebulous things that I may be feeling today. So anyways, that was a long-winded
No, but
answer to that.
it's interesting you say that because I used to work in client success, and one of the things we would do with clients was net promoter scores. And sort of similar to engagement, it depends on how they're doing on that day. If they'd had a bad experience with the product, it would be a terrible score. And yet I look at the whole year and I'm like, the whole year was looking pretty great. Like it doesn't, they don't always equate. But is there anything good that you think comes from an engagement survey or useful?
Again, it's all about, from a survey in particular, I think always that how you're doing it, how you're setting up the survey is the important piece. What are the types of questions you're asking? And again, we've been measuring engagement with Gallup in particular since 1990, and the numbers really haven't changed.
No.
So why are we still measuring? Yet engagement is the thing we're talking about everywhere. Like this is a pervasive conversation, but maybe we're just not measuring the right things. Like that's really what I think we could focus on more so. And maybe we need to, much like leadership, if you go onto Google, leadership has like 10,000 plus different definitions of what it is. Maybe that's the issue, is that are we actually all talking about the same things when we're talking about engagement and what really makes for good engagement? Again, Gallup says this is what good engagement is. But I sometimes wonder too, organizations that are measuring it, sometimes they're also promoting toxic positivity through it. You know, they're saying different things along those lines. You know, we just have to make sure that what we're measuring. So I don't know if I have the exact answer. I know we're focusing rather on engagement. We're focusing on employee experience, and we've convinced a number of our clients to do the same thing, because again, it's all about, do I know how to help myself in these situations? Do I know how to support myself? Do my leaders support these same initiatives? And are we aligned in this messaging? To me, that's kind of the piece around all of it, so that we can get off those moments when, because we all, like, you're right, my motto is work shouldn't suck, but it always does a little bit. Like there's
just life, like, always sucks, like, a little bit, right?
Yeah, like being with my kid 24 hours a day also can suck a little bit at times, although I love her unconditionally.
Totally.
Right. So, and trust can be broken. Sometimes it's broken with my kid when they lie to me. Sometimes it's broken with my husband when, like, I'm disappointed he wasn't reliable. You know, that's going down a different path, but we can also repair that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so again, I just wonder sometimes, you know, are we measuring the right things around engagement, and is it giving? So net promoter scores, I think, are good. I think you have to do them regular, mm-hmm. but you also have to make sure, no matter what you're doing when it comes to surveys and staff and employees in particular, you want to make sure you're actually, anytime you're asking, you're also doing something that's actionable before you go and survey again.
Yeah.
And what I find with some companies anyways, that just do net promoter scores or internal employee, they ask, and then that's just it. And they're just, it's like a quick pulse score. There's nothing to do with the data. Sure, sometimes they'll go report it back. But again, like, if I'm a team member, I don't even know, I've got so much apathy around answering this if you're not doing anything with it.
An hour long survey that you don't necessarily see anything that comes from it.
Exactly. Sure. Exactly. Why bother? So yeah. I actually see that's maybe more what I'm seeing now. I wouldn't suggest that everyone is disengaged or that disengagement is as big as people may think. But I do think apathy is quite large. But that's, I think, because of, we have learned as a society to become apathetic. Otherwise, with everything going on, how else could we survive?
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like apathy is a defense mechanism right now.
We don't want to be disappointed and workplace heartbreak or whatever that looks like.
All of it. Yeah. So that's unfortunately, that is, you know, definitely one of the issues for sure.
Well, one of the trends we do see from engagement surveys or experience surveys is that stress is high. And we're at the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development. They analyzed employee absences in 2023, and they noted a 10-year high in stress leaves. And this is something that I particularly experience with my clients coming to me during a stress leave, after a stress leave, before they're ready to take a stress leave kind of thing. And you work with all sorts of organizations. What are you seeing as it relates to stress in the workplace? Like, what's working? What's not working? What are the trends?
Well, I think we're still in a major hangover from the pandemic, first and foremost. I think, you know, when you tell your body to, you just have to get through it. You just got to keep moving forward. You do until there's a point, and those points are all different for all of us. There is no one size fits all in terms of how we handle stress or who will handle it better and why. So that hangover is definitely real. I can speak for my clients, but I think even from our own personal experience, I have never seen stress as bad as it is right now.
Yeah.
Even in our own, and we've experienced burnout. 2023 was probably our biggest burnout. And I don't love using burnout as fluidly as some of us do, because it's kind of like, maybe I'm saying this wrong as well, so I'll own that. But I, you know, when everyone is struggling with ADHD, or they're getting diagnosed with ADHD, or they think that their kids have ADHD, then those that really have it tend to not get the services that they need. So the same is for burnout. Like, burnout is, when it's acute, it's horrendous and it's awful. And I just want to make sure that, you know, we're not using burnout or the word burnout in a way that kind of dampens it or softens it, because I do want to take, I think we still need to take it very seriously. And so coming back to the question of stress levels are all-time high, I think we forgot how to communicate a little bit during the pandemic. I feel like, you know, interpersonal connections struggled during the pandemic. And now that we're all being somewhat forced to come back into the work environment, that's been harder than we were ready for. We didn't prepare anyone for that. We didn't prepare anyone for what a pandemic would be like. We didn't prepare for what it would be like going back. And so I definitely see there's more of that. I see the organizations that are better at it, though, are the ones who have become more vulnerable and open to talking about it, where the CEOs are demonstrating their own kind of stress levels and where they're at. Those CEOs that are becoming more transparent with work and what that's like and how that is decreasing stress. And those same organizations where transparency is not a value, you know, it's not something that they do, that's where we start to see it, you get what you give. So of course, people are going to start to go off on stress leaves a little bit more open, not be open about how they're feeling, and just suddenly do it. The other thing that we're seeing, and I was dealing with that just this morning, actually, is as soon as people are getting feedback right now, it's usually a day later that we're honestly, we start to see these sick notes come in. And I, you know, whether or not we've been good at teaching people how to give and receive, I would debate we haven't. I think it's difficult. But it is one of those, people are starting to choose themselves. They're learning to choose themselves. So going to go get that doctor's note isn't as tough as it used to be, which, you know, is debatable whether that's good or not, because that also is tough on our medical system as well. But it is easier. And so, yeah, so that's essentially where we are at with all of that. Yeah.
And when we talk about burnout, it's being mentally, physically, emotionally exhausted. And I think a lot of people think, if I just have 2 weeks off, I'll be able to come back and be okay. But realistically, burnout can take 6 to 18 months to properly recover from.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so many people go back from a stress leave to the exact same scenario, expecting it to be different. So what's your recommendation, like from an HR perspective, for leaders or for HR folks on how to, for lack of a better term, like integrate people back from stress leave so we don't end up in the same scenario again?
Again, it's not a one size fits all solution, right? And I think too, it is dependent on how open you've been able to build your relationship with your employee who is going on stress leave. So very similar. I know it's somewhat different, but we teach, you know, when moms are going off on maternity leave, let's talk to them about what they want, what they need during this time. You know, the doctor's note will say, you're required not to work at all, but sometimes that can be stressful too. So talking to the employee to prepare, what does this look like? And after a week, I'm going to check in with you and I'm going to see how you're feeling and what you're doing. Again, you don't have to disclose anything for me, what's going on, but do you want to see, do you not want to see? Like I ask moms that all the time, are you missing Slack? Cause I know I just needed some sort of stimulation during the time. And if not, and so, but again, if part of the reason why team members are going off and they're not disclosing any of this and they kind of are, that's going to be a hard discussion to have. When they're ready to come back, I always encourage having conversations, always encourage having conversations around what accommodations look like for you? And how do you want those accommodations? And being open and getting creative. Chances are you've invested in this person for a long time, and much like turnover, you know, the best path forward is what could we give so that they can get? And I would recommend talking, you know, if you are going off, is to first practice that plan and having that conversation. If you've got a mental health practitioner or a therapist that you're working with, even practicing those conversations in a scenario with them first before you have it with their leader. Because often, again, I know from a mental health perspective, we tend to those stories and that anxiety, or when I'm struggling with my own anxiety, that those stories start to become amplified. And if I can just express it and have those conversations with someone else, suddenly all those feelings and concerns that I'm having are not as scary. And especially if I can practice worst case scenario and best case scenario. And doing that with someone safe first, I think is a great, you know, kind of stepping stone back into having that with my leader. And we can practice, and in that case, I would say practice negative. Well, no, we can't do that. Like, that's sometimes what leaders have said. We can't accommodate you in that. Well, could we try it? Because you know, an organization does have the obligation to look at ways without undue hardship, does have the obligation to look at things through that lens, you know, and to do what they can from an accommodation perspective. But I just find so few people, whether or not, again, this is how you know they are struggling with mental health, those stories are real or not, but really struggle at asking for what they need.
Yeah.
and chances are, even prior to getting to burnout, and this is what we talk about at Elevated all the time, I can't, as a CEO, I cannot read your mind.
Yeah.
I'm known to want to help and to be there. And in one of the conversations I had with a recent departure who left and did not take a job somewhere else, and never once would I have suspected, because we're remote, so never once would I have suspected that burnout or mental health was an issue, or this wasn't, because we talk about it all the time, we build the trust all the time. And, you know, in that case, she said, I didn't want you to see me at my weakest. I was embarrassed. And I'm like, and I said, so what could I have done? Like, what could I have possibly done? I remember really reflecting, because I want to have these conversations. And she said, I don't think there was anything, you know, and I just need this time to kind of just look at my life and where I am right now. And so I'm sure there's something. I'm not so unself-aware that I probably did something along the line to give her a thought process that perhaps she really was unsafe. But on the flip side, you know, I gave her continued chances to say, like, you can just take a leave of absence, you can do whatever it is. And she knew enough working through her person that no, she needed to make a break and have a complete redo of wherever she's going to go in her career. And so again, I don't have a bulletproof answer. What I do know though is, and actually this is where I was going with that story too, is she didn't ask for help. She was afraid to ask for help. And she knew she could. I ask for help. I learned that a long time ago, that part of the reason why my team doesn't ask for help is because I don't do it. And so I need to start modeling that behavior as well, and what that looks like. Even though I'm supposed to be the CEO, there's still times I need help. And so all of that kind of comes into play here.
Do you know, the people that I have tended to work with who struggle to ask for help tend to be the not just high achievers, but those who tie their identity to their job or their workplace. And so it feels, sometimes asking for help feels like a personal failing, not just a work failing, or I didn't, you know, get that extra support on a project that would have made something easier, but it feels like me as a person, I have failed if I am not doing everything right. And I sometimes feel there's no amount of a leader saying and being open about it if someone is still in that place psychologically. And I see it a lot with people younger in their career. If mm-hmm. they're in that place, it's going to take that experience before they move forward and realize, I don't want to do that again. That's not for me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like my husband and I, he can say something to me today and he can say something to me, the same thing to me tomorrow, and I'll have a different reaction to it depending on what's going on in my life. Right.
Yeah. I get it. Yeah. And so it's nice to hear you say that too. from my perspective, because again, you know, like I don't always have all the answers, and in knowing that, you know, you as a leader, you're not always going to have those answers either.
Yeah. Well, I'm hopeful for her that the next move is a great one for her.
Me too. Me too.
So, like we've said throughout the whole thing, there's no silver bullet. There's no one size fits all. Often what I see in the workplace is a lot of band-aid solutions to stress management of like, bring in a workshop. Don't get me wrong. I'm grateful for those. I provide those workshops all the time. Or, yeah. You know, we'll run, a health challenge or something like that. But ultimately, I don't see as many organizations trying to get to the root of an issue, whether that's, workload being overwhelming or psychological safety. Mm-hmm. On the back end of things, because I think so many employees, we don't see how the sausage is made, right? If you know, whether from an engagement survey or just like you can see it, the writing on the wall, that there is a root issue, let's say workload being overwhelming. Who starts, how does that start to get tackled? Like, is it, where does HR come in? Where does the team lead come in? Let's say this is across the whole organization, workload is just bananas because maybe we're understaffed in general. How do those teams work together?
Oh man, if I had the answer to this question.
How should they work together is probably the best.
Well, so this is one of, on our surveys, we do ask about workload. We tend to ask about workload. And that the most interesting thing that I think is important to note here is the most CEOs, and we work with a lot of tech companies too. So there's board or there's a board, and there's typically VC investment, that kind of a thing, that get to see everything. So they see these surveys or these scores as well. And so the one on workload, you know, when it's high and people are happy with their workload, the first thing a CEO says, or the first thing that a VC says, is then they don't have enough to do. You have too many people. And so that's their, so that's very easy for them is suddenly to go, cool, you got to cut some people if there's not a little bit of tension there. And, you know, I'll be honest, with a little bit of friction in life is not a bad thing. If you go to a restaurant and it is crazy hopping, I tend to get the best service.
Yeah.
And there's only four or five tables in there and the server isn't very busy, they're off. It is not the best service that I've ever had. So there is a healthy tension there, just like there is healthy stress, mm-hmm. right? And so the other thing is that I will say, as a CEO, I don't know that someone is overloaded because I have different expectations of what work looks like for me, as I should. This is my baby. And so until, and this is what I say out loud to people, until you say no, I will keep handling stuff for you. Then as a CEO, what I also recognize is I start to watch the work product. I start to watch, you know, how are they meeting deadlines, or are they consistently dropping deadlines? Is this chronic? I don't want to wait till it's chronic. Is it starting to become a little bit more repeatable? So those are questions as a leader I got to ask. The second part of that is, as an employee who does feel like things are busy, I encourage them to have those conversations right out of the gate, and being far more open around priorities, just saying, okay, so you've loaded this onto me. That's awesome. I want to tell you these were the top three things I was working on today. Where would you like me to slot that in? Which one is more, and like building that conversation piece in, because often again, a leader looks at things a little bit differently. And says, you know, gee, I can, you know, maybe, oh, actually that's not even a priority. And if you're not in the day to day and you don't know how to reprioritize, or you're not always, let's be honest, not all organizations communicate as openly as they should, or in the moment as they should, sometimes that's better too. So I encourage that. Last but not least, you know, I'm in HR. I love what an HR profession can do for organizations. But I also don't love the power or the expectation that when someone comes to HR, HR can instantly do something, because mm-hmm. that's not the case. And so when I want to be consulted or I want to demonstrate support is when that employee can show that they have tried to have the conversation with their leader, but it has been unsuccessful. And I'm not there to solve their issue, but I'm there to support them from that. Mm-hmm. So let's take a look at it from a slightly different way. But I typically say, so what have you done right now so far? Just tell me, show me what you've done. What conversations have you had with the leader where, you know, you've tried to solve this? Because as soon as I am involved, now the leader is on edge too.
Yeah.
And so I want to mitigate that as well. But if you are constantly being ignored, if that psychological safety isn't there, I can easily step in. But it is a non-biased step in. So you may not always like what I have to say around that too. You know, we did have to hire and we do have to make sure that, you know, these are the responsibilities. This is what, you know, that conversation might have to have been had. So that's the difficult perspective there, I think.
I just want to interrupt this episode quickly to let you know about our upcoming leadership group coaching program called Less Stress Teams, which launches April 17th. Less Stress Teams is for leaders whose teams are under immense pressures and their stress levels are high. It's hard to know where to start. In this program, we will help you diagnose the root causes of team stress and make an actionable plan to address systemic change. We will guide you through the principles of psychological safety, equipping you with a toolkit to create safer, more harmonious, and happy teams. What I love about our group coaching programs is not only how we take theory and give you tangible actions that you can implement immediately, but how much you're going to learn from your fellow participants. The diversity of thought, industry, and experience brings so much to the table. If your team has been feeling that overwhelm and you're in need of some support to move the needle, this program is for you. To learn more, go to impactfulengagement.com/training. That's impactfulengagement.com/training, and will be linked to in today's show notes. Back to the episode.
So in terms of that dynamic between HR and leaders and where to step in, when it comes to one of the things I hear from a lot of frontline managers or first-time managers is like they've never necessarily had any training. When it comes mm-hmm. to, we talk a lot about psychological safety. Mm-hmm. Who teaches psychological safety in the workplace? Does HR actually, like, is that something that is commonly taught or should be commonly taught?
Oh, 100% it should be commonly taught. I do think that it is. They think that they're teaching it. I think they're putting HR professionals, though, again, I think this is what's hard in the HR profession is, well, you can teach this, right? You're in HR, when they themselves have had no training on what actual psychological safety is or what that looks like. And quite frankly, and I'm going to say this, and most HR professionals may hate me for saying it as well, we are taught in schools to do everything by the book and rule-based. There is no feelings in school that you are, sure, we usually tend to go into the profession because we want to help and support. But I think HR has been taught how to be some of the best gaslighters in the industry. And there is an expectation that if anything, people, that of course you should know how to do this. Of course you've been exposed to this. And most of the time they have been not. So coming back to your question, psychological safety should be taught. When we ask a question again in our surveys about harassment, we break it down into three: physical, sexual, and psychological harassment. And we describe what psychological harassment is. And the amount of leaders who do not believe that tone or excluding people from meetings that they should probably be in, or dismissing people in meetings, cutting them off, leaders don't see that as psychological harassment. But again, I think it's this whole idea of intention versus impact. And so is it always a malicious intent? I don't think so. However, it is what comes out. It is the impact. And so again, it needs to be taught. I think it needs to be taught in any type of leadership development that you are putting in place. HR can go find a practitioner who would be good at teaching psychological safety and psychological awareness and even burnout measures. I will acknowledge we have gone down that path because I hired someone in particular who was dealing with mom burnout and how translatable that was back into the workplace. So we actually have a facilitator who does
Renee is amazing.
Yes, yeah. She's phenomenal. And so I feel because we're equipped, but I don't teach it, you know, like, yes, I'm the CEO, but I don't, and I have all these beliefs, but I personally don't teach it. I coach it if I'm having those conversations of how we can show up better for our team members. But I think right now when HR does it, it's a check off the box thing right now. At most or at best. And I think we've got to move beyond that. And I think, again, team members need to find their voice and sometimes ask more openly than they are that, you know what, I think that this is an issue within our organization and I would like to have more conversations about this. I think that that's an important piece as well that organizations need to adopt and to listen to. So again, I'm not saying it's not HR. I think HR needs to be paying attention, but I think leaders need to be paying attention. I think it is the best organizations is when all three are aligned and they're seeing something and they're proactive in their approach around it is the best way. But I think expecting HR to teach it is not the right call.
I mean, working with people is one of the most challenging things there is, right? Like, so I understand what you're saying of like being taught by the book and maybe less emotions, but like you could have 10 people on your team who all have their own different personal values who just happen to be at the same organization for whatever reason they came to that organization and how they will each respond to pressure, to a question, to, you know, group discussion, like all of that is going to be so unique. And so it's such a muscle that a leader needs to flex, and they're not always going to get it right. The employee doesn't always get it right, but it's such a challenge. So I'm kudos to the organizations, I think, that are really investing in it and practicing it, because it is a practice, right?
Absolutely. And it's, and you're never going to have arrived, you know, no. Just when you think, right. You know, And a checking off a box does not solve anything.
No.
Right. Right. And even those organizations that are so good at handling and supporting and doing the things in the right ways will still have it. I think this is where we're at right now in lives, is that not all of us have been taught to or accept the tools that we have at our disposal. It's one thing to say, you know, Bell, let's talk, you can talk to me at any moment, but we don't do any training for people to actually say, okay, so now if I actually tell you how I'm feeling, that response system, that is so hard, and that creates further stress, I think, for people too, because I don't know how to handle, when am I supposed to escalate versus when am I not supposed to escalate, how do you know, all those questions. So like we're not doing enough, I think, about, I was saying earlier, giving and receiving feedback. We don't do enough to even teach when I'm seeing it, what could I say? Because what I've noticed in my own organization is that when people are starting to get to those stress levels, they themselves don't see it. They're doubling down in some cases. They're you know, hiding it. They're becoming more defensive, but I see it. And so I have two options. I can either turn a blind eye and go, well, they're not saying anything, so I don't have to change anything. But sometimes when I have brought it up, I can see them recoil, or again, toxic positivity. What are you talking about? I'm fine. I just need to go for a run. It's life. No big deal. Right. And because again, that's what they've been taught. And so we need to teach others going, no, you know, or whatever that looks like, but also teach people to say, when I receive feedback like that, what should be like, how can I handle that feedback in a way? Because that's a gift. Someone is giving me information that could save my life, honestly. Mm-hmm. But we get defensive when we get feedback. No, I'm fine. What are you talking about? You know, and that just, I find it's just the cycle that we continue to be on from a mental health perspective. So there's so much more that can be done in this space. But recognizing again that we're not going to be able to save. And that sounds defeatist, so I actually even hate saying that, but there is a mindfulness and there's your own mental health as well that, you know, you also have to protect. And if you are wanting to go out and save the world, I mean, the amount of times that I've just wanted to shake someone and say, like, do you know how much potential you have? Just take, do what you need to do. I'm serious. That's not going to help either. And so recognizing, but I think we can still do more. It's like, it, you know, just like we all have different differences in communication styles and we learn how to show up differently for different communication preferences. I think we can do the same thing with mental health. Mm-hmm. One of the things we do in onboarding is we'll ask a question right out of the gate is, how will you know I'm stressed? So we get them, the employee, to be conscious about it right away, right out of the gate. Like, what are some things that I tend to display when I'm stressed? And so we're talking about it right in that first phase. And I go back to that regularly. It's in one of our files that we have. Mm-hmm. And I'll go back to it because I'll see if that's, you know, if what they told me is also aligning with the story or the things that I'm seeing right now. And then I can bring it up in my one-on-ones. I think another great way for leaders or managers to start having, especially new ones, is when you're doing your one-on-ones, don't just jump into the work. Genuinely ask, how you doing? You know, and if they're like the good, because that's what a lot of people, oh, I'm fine. You know, push as much as you can to kind of talk about life outside of work for a moment or two, because that'll get them in a state of relaxation or of trust, and maybe something else will come out.
Yeah.
You know, that you can have them lead that meeting to maybe telling you more.
Those have been my favorite leaders that I've had that actually cared about who I was as a person and not only about the tasks I was assigned.
Absolutely. And that's, I mean, that's why, you know, it's a old saying by now, but again, people don't quit jobs, they quit leaders, which again, with our kind of turnover that I had last year, like that's a heart thing for me. But at the same time, you know, and that same leader and that same team member, while they can be really good at sometimes, they can also, you know, start to grow apart at other times.
Yeah.
I think again, this comes down to boundaries, permission, being okay with being selfish in a lot of ways too. Like, ask for what you need, ask for what you want. And if you're not getting it, I'm also saying that's okay. That's okay.
Yeah.
Let's help you find somewhere, a place where you will get it.
I like what you were saying about it takes practice to have these conversations. In the same way you were saying someone should practice the conversation to have with their leader about having a stress leave, leaders need to practice. Like, role-playing would be so helpful in so many, like, to do this more often, because those conversations are rarely easy ones to have. So I think practice doesn't make perfect in this scenario, but practice helps.
I know. And so many people cringe when it comes to role playing, and, you know, and what I would suggest is don't suddenly do like a team building. We're going to role play how to have stress conversations. This is still something that we want to have one-on-one, you know, from that perspective. But what we have seen in some organizations is they'll make, you know, some sort of mental health theme. There's a different kind of thing or topic that they'll talk about throughout the organization that month. And one of them can be where leaders are one-on-one having these conversations. And so while it seems a bit contrived, that's actually, like, even public speaking, for example, you get up and you practice. Yeah. And sometimes I'll put stuffed animals up, or sometimes I'll ask my daughter to actually come watch me. It's the practice that makes all of that easier. And so again, even if it feels awkward, you're going to thank yourself later on that you were prepared and you had the words to actually express what you were feeling down the line if it comes to it.
Yeah. And I think the last thing I would just say on the stress, and then we'll move into a slightly different topic, is that don't underestimate what someone is showing up at an organization with in terms of their past workplace trauma. Like, if you just come from being laid off or a boss that you didn't trust or whatever that looks like, you can come to a brand new manager who is psychologically safe, who is a fantastic leader, but you have that baggage and it takes some time to let that go and trust that organization. And so, which makes it even harder for leaders, I totally recognize, but people are complex. It's there's never nothing new to be learned there, for sure.
I you know, I do say people are the hardest part of the job as a leader, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But you know, and if we didn't have people, life would be so much easier, but then I wouldn't have a job and I wouldn't know what to do, because this is all I know. So I'm kind of glad people are part of the job. But again, I have learned over the 14 years at Elevated that I have never been perfect, but also as a leader, giving ourselves some grace and going, I shouldn't be looking for perfect. I should be looking for progress. Yeah. And we are having such better conversations 14 years later than we did when I first started. And there are so many more ways to become aware and conscious and to have better conversations. But it does take putting one step in front of the other, trying something new each and every time. I have to make that commitment. I have to be conscious enough to make that commitment so I can practice it and be consistent around it. And that is, again, it comes down to this consciousness of be the leader. What I've taught myself is be the leader I wish I had.
Yeah.
And then even pivot from there.
Yeah.
Because we are all different.
I love it. On the note of pivoting, I am going to pivot really quick here to a slightly different topic. I have zero data to support this. Right. Beyond the qualitative data that I hear from my clients and my own network and the people in my life, I know so many people who are eager for more part-time professional roles, whether it's job sharing or a four-day work week. And yet you look out at part-time roles and so many of them are those hourly retail or, you know, those types of works. From an HR perspective, why don't more part-time professional roles exist?
It's a great question. I mean, the very black and white answer is for each headcount, I have to pay that person more. So
in terms of benefits and...
Yeah, exactly. So if I'm going to offer benefits, it's each person and that amount doesn't. So even if they're there 30 hours or they're 20, well, 24 hours is usually like the cutoff for benefits. So if they're working 24 hours, it doesn't matter. I'm paying that amount from a benefits perspective. CPP and EI, for example, is also per person. And as an organization, I'm matching that. So these are costs per person, not because it caps out CPP and EI. So if I have one person and 40 hours a week, I'm only paying that amount. But now if I bring in a few more people and depending again, what even their part-time salaries are, that's an additional cost. So that is like the black and white budgeting financial reasons why people do that. For me, so we aren't a 4-day work week. We are 35-hour work week though. And when I went from 40 to 35, I did not change salary. So they still earn the same amount, 40 hours versus 35. I did make that change, but we have the opportunity, but we are not 9-to-5.
Yeah.
So however you want to make that work, I would suggest my team would still tell you that there's no way that they can, you know, like some... because clients come at weird times and we can't predict when clients come at us. So, but what I know and what I get consistently, and we have a channel called Love Notes in Slack, and the amount of times that I get the thank yous for being so flexible, because again, for you to go pick up your kid when they're sick, for you to go just be able to pick up their kid when they're fine, knowing that, you know what, I don't care if this is done at 6 o'clock or if this is done at 7 a.m. like my best work is done at 5:30 to 7:30. That's when I love to work. Knowing that you have that's been the best I know for moms so that they're still earning the salary that they want to earn, and yet they know, again, what it comes down to is trust. And so the no quantitative data that you have is because we are still, I think, very much in a society where we are trust earners as CEOs and leaders in companies, as opposed to trust givers.
Yeah.
And that is why flexibility and that hybrid and that, you know, butts in seats is because they have said, it's because there's a lack of productivity. That's what everyone has said. That's why there needs to be butts in seats. And yet there is a recent study that was just completed, and we actually put it in our newsletter as well, that actually said that shows zero difference. It doesn't say that they are more productive. I'm not going to go out there on a limb and say, actually, from home, they're far more productive. It says that there is no difference. Mm-hmm. So if you have a situation where you can either have people in seats and not be able to tend to life in the way that they need to, or you can give them that, like if I'm a job seeker, I'm choosing the place where I've got flexibility. all day long. And so it could be just such a huge competitive advantage, but let's call it ego. That's what I'll come back to. It's ego. Anyone who is much more of an extrovert, right? They need that energy of people around them. And so I think they use that as an excuse, productivity or a lack of productivity as an excuse, because again, you said you don't have the data. They don't have the data either. I guarantee you it.
Yeah.
And it would be such a difficult study to even set up if you think about it, because productivity is so dependent on what's going on for the organization at that time. What I know is we had an office. There is not in 2019, there is not a day in 2019, I would have thought I could have trusted my staff enough to work from home 5 days a week. Not a day. And then we went, the pandemic happened. We went to the office or out of office, and our productivity, because we track time, mm-hmm. every hour is, we're kind of like lawyers that way. It's the only way that we make money. Mm-hmm. We actually made more with less people because they put in like meeting time, going from client to client. Suddenly there's not those walls in between. It wasn't good either for burnout. Don't get me wrong, but productivity in itself was massive. And I can go back to my calendar and show you my 2019 versus my 2020 and how much more I could fit in mm-hmm. was insane. So to me, that's not a real, it wasn't a real metric.
Yeah.
But I just know what I learned was I'm not any less productive because I can do laundry during the day, or more productive because I did laundry during the day, but I am a much happier person because I was able to handle the laundry during the day and then spend time doing what I actually want to do in the evenings.
Yeah. And I think that's what so many people crave. And I look at these organizations that are forcing people back to the office, and I just think, oh, it just, yeah, I think there's that happy me. I know it's, there's no one size fits all, right? Some people want to be back at the office. Some people don't. Some people, those intentional gatherings, I think, can be so impactful.
And that's what we do. Yeah. We do it once a month. We're intentional, and it's agenda driven. We know exactly what we want to get out of it. We bring each other together. Then we go out for dinner and have that connection time. And then we go back and we do our stuff. And don't get me wrong, like even our clients are asking us to be back in the office with them, but not having to go from our office to the client office, that has been such an emboldened change. However, I will say not everyone knows how to work from home. And that's been a tougher lesson for us too, is how to teach that and how to get ready for that. And especially new workers, I empathize with them greatly, and we've been terrible at teaching them how to work from home and having that discipline. But if you're going to take and get that flexibility and you want that trust, you have to be super disciplined on the communication side and your own time management and being really good at creating your own boundaries and knowing what, you know, that is too. Those are tough lessons. And so I get it. I can see the disconnect, but I had thought this was a gift that the pandemic was actually going to give us, and to see it deteriorating the way it has, I'm so disappointed.
Yeah. Are there any companies that you feel like are doing it really well?
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. I will suggest though, the direct correlation of those same companies who I think are doing a phenomenal job, mm-hmm. their collaboration scores have dropped. When I'm saying on surveys, like they do, and that makes sense, because again, you have to be conscious about how you're collaborating, what you're doing in those moments. Even for us, I joke about it. Tease is my love language. So if our team meetings online, which we do every single Thursday, it's an all hands every single Thursday meeting. Well, if I'm there, I think it still works pretty good. But if I'm not there, the feedback that I get is we're all pretty quiet. Like you got to show up when you're doing, you know, from a collaborative perspective. It's all about your commitment. But again, I also don't want it to be like positive for the sake of positive. I don't want people to be pretending if that's their authentic selves and they're, you know, today I just really just want to sit quietly here and listen to you all at these meetings, be okay with that as well. But it is just so easy to get into your own silos when you are working from home. And it doesn't mean you're less productive. It just sometimes may mean that you forget to pop your head up and check in on certain things. And that can take extra interactions back and forth. And again, written communication, you know, those organizations that really do invest in the tools that make communication easier, I think they're doing it really well. Those organizations that haven't quite stayed on that band, they struggle a little bit more. You just have to, again, it's all about consciousness and intentionality, but it's not like you're not able to overcome it. You absolutely could. Yeah. I'm so happy. I'm done my rent. I found someone to take over our rent during the pandemic. And so the last payment came out this February, and I've never been so happy that, amazing, you know, that stress now, that part of, you know, because you never know with tenants, like what's going to happen and things like that. And so that's done. And I'm so happy to not have rent on our budget sheet. And in turn, though, they do get a technology stipend. They do, like, I do make sure their office equipment we have, and you can ask for anything kind of thing, you know? Anyways, like that's all part of everything that we work through and work on too, but it's not easy, but it wasn't easy being in the office either. So it's this whole choose your heart. And at the end of the day, I choose flexibility. The majority of us are moms. And if we're not moms, then we are for sure dog parents. And to be at home, to walk your dog at the time they need to be walked, that to me is just as important.
Yeah.
I love giving that to my team. And I think we are far more competitive because that's the mindset I come at this with too.
Yeah. I know you said there's been so many changes over the last 14 years. So I'm hopeful over the next 14 years, we'll get to a great place with flexibility and more part-time roles and that kind of thing.
I hope so. Because, you know, money is the one thing, like that's where I was like, the black and white is
totally
benefits in this, right? It still comes down to trust.
Yeah. And outcomes is the work getting done. Yeah. So
but trusting is getting done, right?
Yes. Yeah. Very last question. As a busy entrepreneur with a thriving business, what do you do to manage your own personal well-being?
So I have learned that it's okay to be selfish, and I'm totally good with it. I happen to be I've been married for 23 years. So I have a fabulous partner who also knows that I am selfish and is okay with it. And what I mean by that is, I am okay with, for example, I was just speaking at a conference last week. I extended the trip into the weekend and was by myself for 2 days. And I call them my un-F myself trips, because I take them and I meditate and I run and I do the things that are important for me. And I have taught myself over the years, it didn't start like this, but I taught myself to not be guilty about it.
Yeah.
When you were talking about Renee, Renee says, I never worry. And that's not true. I do worry at times, but I have found in my life that worry has been what's taking me down some deep, dark paths that I don't like to go to. So if I can consciously stay in front of it by recognizing, you know, when I'm starting to get anxious, I need to take time for myself. I'm going to go do. But so often, and more specifically as women, we are taught we are not supposed to be selfish. We are, you know, that's not in the DNA of being a good mom. And that's not in the, and maybe it's because we had my daughter a little bit later and we were really well established in our marriage as well, that I feel okay with taking that time. And I also give it to him as well. Like it's not like hour for hour that we're counting.
Yeah.
But I would say it is the best strategy I've ever been able to do, is to teach myself that it is okay to be selfish. And it is okay to do what's right for me. And even if that means like mental breaks throughout the day, or if that means bigger, like I say, extending a trip because I want to, and that's going to feel good right now. I come back as such a better person.
Yeah.
And so, you know, again, there's no quantitative data with that, but I will tell you the qualitative data, both from my family and from my team, is like, keep doing that.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I so appreciate that. I have my own single mom trip coming up. Well, solo mom trip coming up in May. So I'm so excited for it. Definitely necessary.
It's the best thing. I think it's the best gift you can give yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I loved our conversation today. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you.
Big thank you to Michelle for joining us on the podcast. As she mentioned, you can find her on LinkedIn. I've also in today's show notes linked to Elevated HR and some other places that you can find her and follow the great work that she is doing. Just again, a shout out for our Less Stress Leaders program that is kicking off in April. If you want to learn more, you can go to impactfulengagement.com/training, or you can always email me, victoria@impactfulengagement.com, if you have any questions about the program and want to know a little bit more. So until next week, when we're going to be talking to a recruiter, and this is an episode all about the stress with job hunting. Anyone here tried to apply for a job anytime recently? It's a nightmare. It's an incredibly stressful process. So we talked to Darcy Smith, a recruiter and career coach, about how to stress less in your job search. My final ask today, if you have enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend or rate it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you so much and have a fantastic week.